earnings study for consideration is the Book of Lamentations, authored by, we believe, Jeremiah. And this book, the format of it, the mechanics of the book, are quite well known by scholarship. You can, if one is interested in this subject, of course, in very good encyclopedias or dictionaries, can understand the mechanics, which I will do later. But while that's wonderful, it is very impressive to other people. Really, it isn't that valuable in itself, but it can be useful if we then look behind the mechanics of the Book of Lamentations. And we would liken it to like cracking the shell of a walnut and throwing the kernel away. It's the motive, the purpose in back of this mechanics that becomes far more meaningful. So we'll start with in Isaiah chapter 38, we read something that is very interesting. I think it's verse 9 we'll start. Let's see. Isaiah. Yes, it's verse 9. But before we even consider now, that's where we will study more. But as an introduction, we all remember how that Isaiah, that Jeremiah, was dying. And the Lord sent, he prayed first in connection with his dying, like many do, to be spared death. And he turned his head to the wall for privacy and uttered a silent prayer.
Excuse me, you mean Hezekiah.
Hezekiah, thank you. What did I say?
Jeremiah.
Oh, Hezekiah. And what happened, in the meantime, Isaiah, who was outside in an outer court, as it were, the Lord instructed him to go in answer to this prayer, to tell him that he would have, what is it, 10 years or so to more, his life would be prolonged. But what we'd like to consider more, rather than going verse by verse with respect to that, is the results of that answer to the prayer of Hezekiah, what it did to him. And so then we read, I think verse 9, that is it, the writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, when he had been sick and was recovered of his sickness. I said, in the cutting off of my days, I shall go to the gates of the grave. I am deprived of the residue of my years. I said, I shall not see the Lord, even the Lord in the land of the living. I shall behold man no more with the inhabitants of the world. My age is departed and is removed from me as a shepherd's tent. I have cut off like a weaver my life. Incidentally, weaver, when they finish a garment, they snap the cord, tie a knot, and tuck it into the weave of the garment. And this is the snapping off of the thread of life. Yeah, it's like, and he will cut me off with pining sickness from day even to night. Wilt thou make an end of me? I reckon till morning that as a lion, so will he break all my bones. From day even to night wilt thou make an end of me. Like a crane or a swallow, so did I chatter. I did mourn as a dove. Mine eyes fail with looking upward, O Lord. I am oppressed. Undertake for me. What shall I say? He hath both spoken unto me, and himself hath done it. I shall go softly all my years in bitterness of my soul. O Lord, by these things men live, and all these things the life of my spirit, and so wilt thou recover me and make me to live. Behold, for peace I had great bitterness, but thou hast in love to my soul delivered it from the pit of corruption, for thou hast cast all my sins behind thy back. He felt that this sickness was due as retribution for some of the things that he did formerly in his life, and that he felt that he should have lived longer, and he recognized this illness as a sort of a punishment, and his conscience bothered him and led to the prayer that was answered. For the grave cannot praise thee, death cannot celebrate thee, they that go down into the pit cannot hope for thy truth. The living, he shall praise thee as I do this day. The Father to the children shall make known thy truth. He made this utterance in writing. Notice how it started. It said the writing of King Hezekiah. He wanted to record for posterity his own children, let alone the nation of which he was the king, a memorial of his experience that it might be a benefit to others. The Lord was ready to save me. Therefore, we will sing my songs to the stringed instruments. Now, he has composed this writing, and it was put to music. Mm-hmm. What we have already read was put to music. And now he's saying, as king now, as your leader, as the nation, let us now sing this composition that I have put together. For Isaiah had said, let them take a lump of figs, lay it for a plaster upon the boil, and he shall recover. Hezekiah also had said, what is the sign that I shall go up to the house of the Lord? All right, now what we note here first is this about the singing of a song to a stringed instrument. Now this that we have read previously, the words were used, it was made into sort of like a hymn, music was composed, and it would be sung, the wording, and used, and stringed instrument, a song, and an orderly composition, like we read in the hymn book. But now the thing is this. We have the Psalms. That was the purpose of the Psalms with regard to King David, who was the second king. Hezekiah is way down the line. And so the Psalms were all put to music and with wordings and the experience of King David. So there's a lot of emotion put into these writings, whether it's the Psalms or this one of Hezekiah's experience. Now, when they were taken captive to Babylon, we had that famous one, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat down, yea, we wept. We went remembrance of Jerusalem came to mind. We hanged upon the willows. Here's where we get the weeping willow. We hanged upon the willows there. That is in the midst of Babylon. Those who took us into captivity required of us a song. They that hated us wanted a mirth. They wanted a mirth. How can we sing in the midst of a heathen land? I mean, it's incompatible to sing a song of mirth with this background experience that they had. And so we find also, it says, if I do not call to remembrance, O Jerusalem, thee to remembrance, O Jerusalem, let my right arm be like useless. Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth under that circumstance. This is the song of Babylon that the Jews sang. I'm just ad-libbing it, that, but you can see there's a lot of emotion involved. Let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. And all this had to do. And then it ends very interestingly. Let's see. That would be Psalm 137.
Right.
Let me get that. Let's see. That would be earlier, wouldn't it? 137. But what? Now, notice that if I do not remember thee, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. Now, the chief joy in life should be superseded by that of God, what God has done. In other words, the temple was more important. It's being rebuilt, restored. That desire to go back to the homeland is more important than any personal, private joy that they may have in other avenues of life. All right, now we go to Lamentations. Now, when we come to the book of Lamentations, many question whether Jeremiah is even the author of it. But knowing Jeremiah, his emotions that have been expressed in the 52 chapters that he has written, it can be gleaned from there almost word for word, some little phrases in this Lamentations, heartfelt emotional expressions that Jeremiah himself felt and uttered and wrote down, had Baruch record them. Now, in considering Lamentations, we find that it's a very unusual book. For instance, it's 5 chapters. Now, the way it's designed, let's say like a book. Now, you don't get this in your dictionaries and all, but it's 2 chapters, a third chapter, 2 chapters, conclusion. So it's really 2, 1, 2. It's like this book, where it's folded on the table. The middle part is the third chapter of Lamentations. The first two are here, the latter two are here. Now, what do we find that we read the first chapter? We find it's 22 verses. All right? And that corresponds to at the time of when this was written, to the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet. We have, 25, I think, in the English language. They had 22 anciently, and later on, 24. It changed. And so when Revelation came along, it was customary to have 24 books rather than the 22, the letters of the alphabet. We also have ideas which letters were used. That's not the subject matter today. I don't know if anything been said on that, but I have private conjectures. All right, now here, we find when we read the first chapter that every verse starts with to speak it in English, A, the first verse, the second verse, B, the third verse, C, the fourth verse, D. But in Hebrew, we find all the way down the alphabet. This reminds me somewhat of David in the 119th Psalm, which is called, I think, the Song of Degrees. You have certain principles along that line, but you'll have a whole psalm, A, whole psalm, B, for, of the alphabet, as it were. Now here, we find that the first chapter has 22 verses that way, A, B, C, D. The second chapter, A, B, C, D. But when you come to the middle chapter, you have A, 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 B, 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 C, 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 D, 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 yeah, that way. Three, which is quite different. It's strikingly different. Then when you come to the last two, the fourth chapter, you find back to the 22, back like in the beginning. And then when we come to the last one, while it's 22 verses, it is now different than the entire book in that it's done in a different fashion. It's 22 verses, but it's not A, B, C. But what is happening, you have, like in the concluding chapter, like a sort of a Gregorian chant. I never read anything about it, but we had in the Catholic religion that Gregorian chant. There's a rhythm to it, and this is a Hebrew rhythm. And so when it starts out, the last chapter, after one verse, which is introductory, from then on, there is this cadence of a double, and then two verses of another type of rhythm, and then a double. Then it's hard to explain it. To the double that is inserted between every two verses. So you'd have every third verse would have this two short verses, very, very terse. And those two verses that are very terse is part of a chant, like verily, verily, as it were, and the two. And so you'll have like the verse one, then you have verse two, three. But now from 2-3 on, it's 2-3, 1-2, 2-3, 1-2, 2-3, you see, all the way through. And it shows that there was a Hebrew rhythm used. I know of no book on this subject, so everything I'm saying is like conjectural, except the facts that this is the way it is set up. But the reason behind it is that this was designed as a very meaningful conclusion to the four chapters preceding, which are very emotional and are lamentations. They are lamentations. And so when it comes to the last, it would be like the people now, like they used to have in the Catholic religion. You have somebody, and when I went, that's 70-some years ago, when I was in the Catholic Church, one would lead the leading in Latin, and then the audience would be like the chorus, would repeat, and they would have a hymn book where you could pronounce the Latin as a chorus. This is the same thing here. So we would think that what happens when it comes to the two short verses, that would be the chorus, and the two longer verses would be of a nature of the cantor, like the Hebrew cantor. He would sing in a prolonged fashion, one verse, and then another verse, and then the two short ones. We do not see it in the English because it's not in Hebrew. And unfortunately, in the Hebrew Bibles, which are so careful not to speak about the name of Jehovah, here, they don't separate this the way it's written, where it would be beautifully seen, not only as a song. Moffat tries to do these things in the Bible, where this thing occurs. He is the only one I know that has the earliest I know of American Bibles that we have, where had did this and formatted it. But of course he couldn't start it with Aleph, Beth, Gamma, and so forth, because nobody would understand it. But he would do it in the English, and then you put a Hebrew A, Hebrew B, at the side of the verse. And in that way you would see right away it's meant to be congregational song, solo, congregational, and it would be done with this peculiar fashion. Now, another reason for putting it A, B, C, that those who would desire in their hearts to memorize this song, it is helpful that you know that you're looking for that word, that Aleph or Beth or whatever it is. Now, when it's used throughout the book, you'll find that the beginning word, while the letter of the beginning word in Hebrew would correspond with this mechanical method that is used, it could be a verb, it could be an article, it could be a noun, it could be an adjective, but it has to start with that thing. So we're going into this because it's not explained. And now the thing is, now you have the mechanics. And we then now can, as it were, feel what it was like there when it was done in this fashion, to music, to the stringed instrument primarily, because this is a soliloquy. This is not jazz. This is a mournful song. And when you pluck a string, there is a delay. It's not like a piano or something like that. It's ting, and then it fits in with the mood of the song being sung and the words. Now we've done, so far, the mechanics, the background, but then now comes about Jeremiah. We feel that there's internal evidence can prove that, and I'm not going to try to do that this morning at all, but it can be done. Next thing, this song could not have been composed while the city was being destroyed, where a great bulk of the subject matter of it is what happened during the siege of the king of Babylon, of the city, what he personally witnessed at that time, the dreadful carnage later, the disease, the hunger, whatever it might have been, that he recorded. But this could never have been done under his normal lifespan when he preached, even when he went down to Egypt. The circumstances were not conducive to this. This is like a prophet who is in retirement, who is now thinking, meditating on the past, long after this, he is now writing this. So we believe, where was he? We believe he was in Babylon. We think there's clues that would show that there, rather than in Egypt, because the Bible ends up with him in Egypt and nothing about his death or the latter part of his life. We have surmised and mentioned in other studies a couple things that we think indicated he went to Babylon. This required time and a subtle condition where he could think of the mechanics. Now, when you made the mechanics, he first would write from his heart what he felt of all these things. Then he would have to go over that to put it into the format that would be useful for the people to participate. And so then he would change each sentence or whatever it might be. He could change the wording. And we could take one sentence, but I haven't got time, because this I'm just thinking of it spontaneously. But we could take one sentence and present it three different ways and be grammatically correct, but being put in a different way. And especially the Hebrew language is done that way. And so we feel then it was reworked, what was from his heart, and put into this mechanical mode, but yet the emotions are still there. And that's all. This is just an introduction to the study of the Book of Lamentations, which now we would hope to do. You know, I didn't bring my watch with me, but let's see. What time is it now? The title, The Lamentations of Jeremiah, is very appropriate. In the King James Version that I have, it says at the beginning of verse 1, Jerusalem's misery for her sins. Let's have a reading now of three verses. Sister Esther, and then Sister Gail, and Brother Darrell.
How doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? How was she become as a widow, she that was great among the nations, and princess among the provinces? How was she become tributary? She weepeth sore in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she hath none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They are become her enemies. Judah is gone into captivity because of affliction and because of great servitude. She dwelleth among the heathen. She findeth no rest. All her persecutors overtook her between the straits.
All right. Verse 1. How doth the city sit solitary? That is alone. That was full of people. How is she become a widow, as a widow, she that was great among the nations? Now this book of Lamentations is extremely dramatic. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to break up the verses in the convenient form in which you had a change of venue from one personage to another. For instance, now, he is viewing the city as empty, picturing it as a woman, but he's picturing it as a land, as ground, province, territory, nation, devoid of inhabitant. And he's looking at her. It's as though he is looking at this woman who is in this mournful situation, in the sitting posture, with head bowed, weeping. This is the city. This is very dramatic. And he's viewing it and recording what he's seeing. He's recording as though he's actually seeing it. The land devoid, that once was great among the nations. It was small, but you had the temple, you had Solomon's wisdom, you had David's conquering battles, the exploits, the slaying of Goliath, a great history, and then not only great in the sense of powerful, but there was a sort of a beauty attached to the city, because the temple was one of the seven wonders of the world. So there's a beautiful aspect, plus other aspects of the city. Now it is in ruins. And how is she become tributary? Tributary, well, right away, you know, that means she's now, instead of being in the leading role, she's now a subject of another nation. The word, I think, is a tribute payer. Not only like a satellite nation, but required annually to give a large sum of money, a tribute, to pay tribute, give gifts, taxes, like Caesar issued a decree that all the land should be taxed, you know, in Jesus' day. So here, a city now in servitude and betrayed by all her friends and lovers. Now, when you come to verse 2, she weepeth sore in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. I tell you, this could not be any more dramatic. This is powerful. And this is Jeremiah. He is so, what do they call that, when you are looking like the dove in a dove that is faithful and well cared for, when they see that the master, whoever has been taken care of, is sick, the dove dies. The canary dies, or doesn't sing anymore. There's an empathy that seems to develop that between even animal and the human in some cases. So here, Jeremiah, is almost like this woman himself. The very fact that he takes this as a subject matter shows the character of Jeremiah and why the Lord used him. And he was faithful in that which was committed to his charge, Jeremiah, during his lifetime. She weepeth sore in the night. What's in the night? That could be translated various ways, but she's not in daylight. It's the sun is no more shining on her, figuratively speaking. It's darkness. It's like a spiritual darkness beclouding the land. So all the circumstances surrounding the city, picture it in a most mournful aspect. And among all her lovers, she hath none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her, become enemies. So now you have two verses of this woman sitting. Now, he is witnessing it, and he is like saying, this is what I'm seeing. And he's actually like seeing it, as it were.
Brother
Frank, yeah.
He's remembering it.
Yeah.
Or meditating on it
yeah.
later.
Yeah, oh yes, that's right. And reliving the experiences. That. Now we read verse 3, Judah is gone into captivity because of affliction. Well, Jeremiah was the prophet primarily to the true tribe kingdom. What was left of Benjamin and Judah. The other was a century before had their retribution. So it's Judah gone into captivity. And it says, and because of great servitude. Well, the conjunction there is can give you a sort of a wrong slant. It's because of her sins. Of her, what she did, the upper crust, particularly of Judah, oppressed the poor. Just like Jesus, remember at the first Advent, he criticized the leadership in that, with regard to especially the ecclesiastical, that they took advantage of the widow and had her sign over the property to the church. This is done now. It has been done down through the age. And it can even be done in our midst, subconsciously, and not done, where people want the wills to be given to the committee, whatever you want to call it. So what we have here is that it was for convenience sake when it's the rich have many friends, the powerful have many friends. But when the tables are turned, then a true friend is revealed. A true friend sticks like glue when misfortune happens and the tables seem to be turned. And it's because of her treatment of others that retribution has come upon her. Now he pictures her in the third verse as dwelling among the heathen and finding no rest, spiritual rest particularly. Now, when it says that all her persecutors overtook her between the straits, what does that say? This is very interesting, because this is conjecture, but what is very interesting to know, notice, that the wars that take place against Israel are conveniently scheduled to start on their holy days. When they're having, for instance, was a six-day war, they timed it, was it for Yom Kippur or some special religious holiday when they would be distracted, and that's the time the enemy strikes. And this information becomes useful in interpreting certain chronology, which is not the subject matter this morning. But that when she was at in a circumstance not convenient for her to defend herself, the enemy took advantage, timed it, waited for the moment of weakness before making the attack. And that in between this, they are meditating, preparing for a strike, and waiting for, in the interim period, for the strait, for the circumstance that would be unfavorable to the Jew, but favorable to the enemy of the Jew. And this is the way they have treated Israel, and they do today. The journalists today, the media, is not that they favor the Palestinians more than Israel. Instead of being impartial and presenting it both ways, it's slanted more to stir up attention to the wrong party. Let us read 4 through 6 next.
The ways of Zion do mourn, because none come to the solemn feasts. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted, and she is in bitterness. Her adversaries are the chief. Her enemies prosper. For the Lord hath afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions. Her children are gone into captivity before the enemy. And from the daughter of Zion all her beauty is departed. Her princes are become like harts that find no pasture, and they are gone without strength before the pursuer.
All right. Now, when it says the ways of Zion do mourn, it's telling, in effect, that not only is the city desolate, without inhabitant, but there's no traffic on the roads leading into the capital. Because what happened 3 times a year, the people had to go there to the temple and so forth, at the special holy days, they congregate there. So there's the roads leading are now empty. So it's saying the ways to come to Zion, to enter Zion, they likewise, not only the city, but the surrounding territory and the gates. Whether it's the gates of the temple, they're gone. Whether it's the gates of the city, they're gone. They're despoiled. And then, so this is talking of the material, the land itself, the land, the landscape. But now you have her priest's sigh. Now, the way it's entered here, it should be separated. Her priests are now in Babylon. They're not there. He doesn't mean to infer that the priests are left there in this city, which he says there's no inhabitants alone, that all of a sudden there are priests there who are mourning. And so, no, the priests who served in the temple, the princes who served in the judicial or the civil government, they are now taken captive into a foreign land. So this should be like it's a change of venue suddenly, but it's hard to bring it out in print, because when you read it, you just slur over it, And it's really a break in thought. He turns from the land, and now he says, those formerly others are mourning who were leading figures in connection with the administration of the city. Her gates are desolate, and that's the gates you had the judges in the gates. And her virgins are the ones who were taken captive for wives or concubines by the conquerors. So they're in captivity, who were once the virgins. And it was very brutal how these, many don't know too much about history, but how they determined the virgins when they took captive is very, very, very emotional how they did that, how they could prove it. And it shows that all the decorum and all this cover and nice, they're just stripped of everything. And the inhabitants and the Jerusalem in captivity, that is the people who have been brought there, they are in great bitterness, like Nehemiah, the cupbearer, who was mourning before the king, and he noticed, Jeremiah, you're not yourself today. What's the matter with you? Mm-hmm. And he said, then he prayed instantly, oh God, help me to say the right thing. And then he says, because the gates of the city of the Jerusalem of my homeland, they are in utter ruin, the city is desolate, that I mourn for that situation. And then that prayer was answered, and remarkably, given a 12-year leave of absence to go back, Nehemiah. And now we come here, for the Lord hath afflicted her for the multitude of transgressors. Your children are gone to captivity before the enemy. Self-explained. Now when you come to verse 6, from the daughter of Zion, all her beauty is departed. And princes have become like hearts that are find no pasture, that they are gone without strength before the pursuer. We, most of us, live in an artificial life. We do not see the deer and wildlife, which they did, say, a century ago. America, primarily, you had your own garden, your own sustenance, no supermarkets and so forth. And so noticing the heart with the being, finding no pasture, is very pathetic. Your heart goes out to the animal creation. They are gone without strength. Mm-hmm. Now we have verse, 7, mm-hmm. 8, and 9. Whose turn is that? Is that Brother Darrell? Okay. 7, 8, 9.
Jerusalem remembered in the days of her affliction and of her miseries all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the enemy, and none did help her. The adversary saw her and did mock at her Sabbaths. Jerusalem hath grievously sinned, therefore she is removed. All that honored her despised her, because they have seen her nakedness, yea, she sigheth and turneth backward. Her filthiness is in her skirts, she remembereth not her last end. Therefore she came down wonderfully, she had no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy hath magnified himself.
All right. And so this is, it's self-explanatory as we read this. And now they're in captivity in a foreign land, and he wants the prophet not to do like so many do when they have tragedy come into their life. why did the Lord do this to me? Why me? Why? It's as though they question their own unpleasant situation, that somehow the Lord is not interested, or is disinterested in their circumstance. Lest Israel in captivity forget and become non-Jews, forget their background and history, this is done to keep in remembrance why Israel underwent this very unpleasant experience of the captivity and the destruction of the city and the temple. Why that was done? It's because of her fault, not God's fault. God really did them good in causing their present circumstance, in waking them up. And even secular writers now notice that Israel no more has heathen religions. This is a very peculiar thing. It's the business world that they're in. It's business or industry that their leadership in science. But you don't find different religions. It's a non-religious. So now it's going to the other extreme. Instead of having the Queen of Heaven making cakes to her and so forth, and Moloch and other types of worship of different varieties of their former religious deflection from Jehovah. And now the idol is mammon, money, power, wealth. That's the religion. And Jeremiah wants them to get back to God, the real giver of every good and perfect gift. And here the heart not finding pasture. And they're in this weakened strait. They are gone without strength before the pursuer. And they are taken advantage of. Just as the Romans could at any time, if they were in the journey, if they saw a Jew, they could have them carry the luggage or do up to a certain milepost. They had mileposts and in the land. That was, when you went along the Roman road, it was metered to the distances. And they could harangue anybody if they saw a Jew. By law, they could, and if they didn't obey, kill them. They would be with the impunity. So it was, they did that. Now, the same thing here with those in Babylon. When they were there, the people who were indigenous to Babylon itself, the citizenry of Babylon, had a superior status to the captives, and it would manifest itself in the social business world in various ways, where there would be like this anti-Semitic other feelings, and they could feel it, even though they had food, even though they had homes, and so forth. And then Jerusalem remembered in the days of her affliction, of her miseries, all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old. Now this is what Jeremiah was trying to tell them when he was before the captivity. The reason you're having this problem is because you're not following the Lord's instruction. And what were the days of old? The days of Solomon, David, and even Saul. There were different circumstances. And but as the period of the 500 years of the kings, as it were, you had this going downhill, as it were, with very, very few exceptions of good kings. Um, good King Josiah you did hear about. Not many too favorable. None did help her, that the adversary saw her, and they did mock at her Sabbath. Now, the adversaries mocking at the Jewish Sabbath at the time they had there would be when she was in captivity. The Jews did go, like to Ezekiel, or to some particular notable who was in captivity, and they would observe this, but they're in a foreign land. And they mock it. Actually, if they were in their own land before, they would envy the Jew. During the years of her posterity, when you had the Temple of Solomon, when you had the Queen of Sheba coming to see the wonders of the architecture and the wisdom of the king and so forth, and the gardens and all the beauty of the city, they wouldn't mock that. They would be envious. Moab and Ammon, when they would look down on the hills and see all the people coming on the holy day, they didn't mock those holy days. But when you read this, you could get off. That's why you have to recognize that there's a change of venue from different perspectives. It was when she was in captivity that they had a house that they would meet at, no temple. Or they'd meet by a river or whatever. And they would observe the faithful Jews who would be Orthodox in these foreign lands. They would know it was their responsibility. It's the Sabbath. We should now be thinking of God rather than of our secular work. And so now in these congregations, to these pitiful situations where they're going to a house or a river or standing out in the plain, that they then could make fun and mock the strange customs of this strange people. But not when she was in her posterity, no. They would be jealous. Now that was 7, 8, and great Jerusalem hath grievously sinned, therefore she's removed. All that honored her despise her, because they have seen her nakedness. Yea, she sigheth and turneth backward. And then, all right, now the first part is very plain. She's grievously sinned, and that's why she's been removed into captivity. All that previously honored her, now despise her. And because of two reasons. One is they see her now as a captive people in a foreign land in a different circumstance, and not back in the days of her glory when she was clothed with honor and so forth. Now he is saying, the people now in bondage, when they think of her, when the Jew, say you're a Jew in captivity, and you're thinking of back there, the former situation, how she was honored, then now in captivity, when she thinks of that, she turns her head and sobs, as it would turn it backward in that. Yeah. And he wants Israel to see that the reason for that experience was because of her sin. Not God was thoroughly righteous in visiting at this judgment, and the prophet wanted to make sure that lesson got across to them. Now then we read verse 9, her filthiness is in her skirts, and she remembereth not her last end. Therefore she came down awesomely. In other words, the destruction was a terrible destruction, awesome to behold because of the seeing the temple being the bricks and the masonry being smashed, the woodwork being burned, the gates being destroyed. This is caused wonderment, puzzlement. And she had no comforter.
But Frank, it's just wonderfully, and that doesn't make sense.
No. But back there, in the old English of the King James, the words meant completely different than they do today. And it was a macabre undertaking. Like macabre is something like almost supernaturally
devilish,
but not wonderful in the sense of isn't that nice? No. So our language today has considerably changed. Now the heathen nations even told the Jew why they were in captivity. The reason is your God forsook you. That is rubbing it in. And the filthiness being seen in their skirts, like it says in another, how did you know a harlot? A harlot, you'd look at the forehead. Well, today we don't have people using what they call a phrenology, the study of the skull, where in the past a lot of this was done. And was useful at that time. For instance, the immigrants who came to America when they came to Ellis Island, and they came down off the ramp for the two inspectors would look at the faces of the people coming down. They'd look at the eyes, particularly the eyes, and to see if they are sick, if there's something wrong, either mentally or physically wrong. And these people were trained what to look for, and they didn't have to tend and take a stethoscope out and examine your heart and all that. You would then be sorted out. Now, in the sorting out, that would be done on Ellis Island. That they would be taken there for detention, and then to screening from there. But when they came off the boat, many of them were let go in. They didn't all have to go there. So this sorting out process. So the filthiness in the skirts, in principle, is that it would be discerned. And just as in the natural land, when they were on the hilltops, and they were harlots for the revenue of a heathen goddess, when they, for instance, Ashtore, that what happened. Well, they're Ashtoreth, the female one. There's the male and the female. They were known by their looks. There was that living that type of life. It had its imprint, and plus the soiling of their garments, literally, laying down on the ground. They're rumpled. Their attire rumpled, and therefore they wore clothes to hopefully disguise that as much as possible.
Brother Frank, you know, you think today, just the very boldness in the face.
In the garment.
There's something about it where a person that is not of a good character seems to have a frontage of dislike, you wouldn't want to have anything to do with it.
Yes. And therefore she came down in this terrible, awesome leveling, brought down to a lower state and without having comforter. Now notice, Jeremiah, even as he's describing this, is overcome. Oh, Jehovah, behold my affliction. He sees the affliction of his people, and he says, it's my affliction. It's he has so empathetically entered into this situation, like Daniel did in his prayer. So Jeremiah was a very, very unusual personage. And behold, the enemy hath magnified himself. Let's read 10 and 11, Sister Esther.
The adversary hath spread out his hand upon all her pleasant things, for she hath seen that the heathen entered into her sanctuary, whom thou didst command that they should not enter into thy congregation. All her people sigh, they seek bread. They have given their pleasant things for meat to relieve the soul. See, O Lord, and consider, for I am become vile.
All right, now, when he says, O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy hath magnified himself, he's now saying that during the downfall of the city, when they broke the gates and flooded into the city, the rampage, the destruction that was wrought by the army of the king of Babylon when he entered the city, he sees it, he saw it, he witnessed it. And the entrance into the sanctuary, they went into the temple, into the most holy. They went not only into where you couldn't go into the inner court, they went to the inner court, they went into the holy, they went into the most holy, the heathen. And here, seeing this take place, that the ancient religion of God that he had established in Israel, being invaded by this heathen power, that it was very traumatic for the prophet himself to even talk about this subject. You know, there are people, what about the Holocaust? When they talk it, they break down in tears, or they get seizures when they think of it. The memory makes them distraught. And so it's very few of them that they can get to give a rational explanation of the Holocaust that took place even in recent times. And they enter into the sanctuary, and thou didst command that they should not enter into thy congregation. Now, when Israel was in its days of glory, they had the court of the Gentiles and in Solomon's temple. But you could not go beyond that. And they obeyed it. The Gentiles did not go. They did not go into the court of the women. They didn't go into the court of the Levites or the priests. They didn't go into the holy or most holy of the temple. They obeyed because they were a renowned, even though it's a little nation, they were renowned for and admired when they were in their glory. Now he's witnessing it. All these no-nos are now yes-yes to the enemy. They can do what they will in entering the thing. And so he's brokenhearted, Jeremiah, when he thinks back of what he saw himself, that when he was spared, and taken into private custody because of finding favor with the king of Babylon, because of his right attitude and his outspokenness. Now he goes into verse 11, which has been read. All the people sigh, they seek bread. He's seeing now the famine that took place at the time in 606, when the city was being overtaken, that there was this famine that existed, and that to get bread they would give their most treasured objects to the ones that had a supply they could give. Now, who were the ones that could give? We understand that there was this gigantic pile of a cereal in the middle of the city that was there. But we also believe that on the side, that the elite, the king, his princes, the priests, had a separate supply for them. And they were in the position, having more for a while, to dole out to the people to get their goodies, their possessions, family possessions, for a song, for a piece of bread. They'd sell them a very treasured thing. But then later on, when there's no bread, well, then that was a different story. And they fled the city, but were captured. So the people that even under this dire circumstance, they took advantage one of the other for me to relieve the soul. See, O Lord, and consider, for I am become vile. Yeah, so just like John, the revelator, said amen when some good news in the revelation was spoken, here, Jeremiah, when the bad things happened, he says, this is affecting me. I feel most miserable. So in verse 9, the last part, O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy hath magnified himself. And then the last part of verse 11, O Lord, and consider, for I am become vile, is very personal to concerning Jeremiah himself. Before in the verse, he's talking what he's beholding, what he beheld back there, and then the effect that it had upon him. And then, let's see, can we read? Have we time for more?
Mm-hmm.
Let's read three more verses, whose turn?
Is it nothing to you, all ye that pass by? Behold, and see if there be any sorrow like unto my sorrow, which is done unto me, wherewith the Lord hath afflicted me in the day of his fierce anger. From above hath he sent fire into my bones, and it prevaileth against them. He hath spread a net for my feet. He hath turned me back. He hath made me desolate and faint all the day. The yoke of my transgressions is bound by his hand. They are wreathed, and come upon my neck. He hath made my strength to fall. The Lord hath delivered me into their hand, from whom I am not able to rise.
Alright. Now, when he says, this is Jeremiah, is it nothing to you, all ye that pass by? Behold and see if there be any sorrow like my sorrow? Jeremiah's sorrow. You know, I think this... God's tears have been greatly mistook. I can't understand this God weeping and bemoaning all the things that happened. And this is Jeremiah, where that should be translated back into his prophecy. That Jeremiah and Israel had to go. The righteous in Israel underwent a similar experience to this. Is there any sorrow like unto my sorrow, which is done unto me, wherewith the Lord hath afflicted me? He takes it personally. Daniel took it personally. And he was a righteous man. Look at, he made a vow not to eat unclean meat, so much so that even at the king's table, he put that request in, which would normally, off with your head, are you ungrateful wretch? No, the king favored Daniel. And him and the three Hebrew children and saw to it that they got their diet. Took courage to do that. Now when he says, all ye that pass by, what is happening, when he is composing this, during the writing of this, he was in this mood, and it showed in his daily comportment. I don't think this was done overnight by any means, the five chapters of Lamentations. And while he was doing this, people would see Jeremiah's behavior. and they would wonder what is the matter with him. And the ones that would pass by would be fellow Israelites, primarily, that he is concerned with. And he's in a low period. So it shows that Christians, as well as prophets, sometimes have a high and a low period in their emotional experience. That it's nothing necessarily wrong to have these emotions. Some people look on it that you should be like a Stoic. A Stoic is one who has no emotions. And even inwardly, see. Some people have it inwardly but don't show it outwardly, but have it. But the real what they call Stoic is one who cuts off thoughts along such lines. And now where were we?
Verse 12.
Yeah, I lost the place. And wherewith the Lord hath afflicted me in the day of his fierce anger. And then he mentions about how it's affected him. Even he has sent this like a consuming fire into his bones, not the fire of zeal. You know, so there's a negative fire in the bones, and there's a positive fire in the bones. One is where you causes you to rise up with enthusiasm and zeal, and the other puts you into depression. And that he, in this mood, he had to be for quite a while he composed this book. For the period of time that it took him to record all these verses, it was a period of lamentation, of very depressed thoughts, and with regard to the lessons upon the people, and then further depressed in that the majority did not see it quite the way he did. But those who appreciated Jeremiah, yes, a minority would appreciate it, of which nothing is said here. But then, what was the other? 12, 13? The fire of the bone, he hath spread a net for my feet. He hath made me desolate and faint all day. Did we read 14?
Yes.
The yoke of my transgression is bound by his hand. They are wreathed, they come up to my neck. He hath made my strength to fail, to fall. The Lord hath delivered me into their hands, for whom I am not able to rise up. Now, he likens himself figuratively, spiritually, as it were, bound up like some chains. Usually you see them with the hands behind the back or their elbows chains put in, but some have the chains wrapped around their torso, where they put the thing around each wrist, and then the chain brings up the arms wrapped like this all the way up to the neck. And down a good deal of the torso. They wrap it like a cocoon. So you can walk, but you cannot do anything. You can't scratch yourself if you got an itch. A most horrible experience. And he likens himself, he has become so emotionally involved for his people that he is suffering like the dove. The sickness is entering into him. And he knows that the Lord is punishing them, but he has entered into it so much as to so, even though he's favored among the captives, Jeremiah, he was favored. But he feels as though he's not favored. So we begin to see that the Lord deals with imperfect people, and he understands what he says, they're down-sitting and they're uprising. The Lord says that he is aware of. And the Lord that delivered me, I'm not able to rise up. And but we feel, well, we better not go into that. We'd like to finish now, just 15, 16, 17. Next.
The Lord hath trodden underfoot all mighty men in the midst of me. He hath called an assembly against me to crush my young men. The Lord hath trodden the virgin, the daughter of Judah, as in a winepress. For these things I weep. Mine eye runneth down with water, because the comforter that should relieve my soul is far from me. My children are desolate, because the enemy prevailed.
All right. Now, it says that the Lord hath trodden underfoot all my mighty men. Well, the Lord had, it isn't the Lord had, that he is the one that's, the ones that in Israel who have this experience of being in captivity and away from their homeland. Jeremiah, likewise, is experiencing the same thing. Even though he was given some preferential treatment, he is so emotionally involved that he's not happy in this new situation at all. And then when he says, my mighty men in the midst of me, that is the people of Israel, the people of God, who are surrounding Jeremiah, that they are being trodden underfoot. His fellow Judahites, they in captivity. And the prophet himself is so emotionally enters into this situation that he is like he's like in the midst of this depressed people, and he is talking about his situation that he feels that the Lord has done this to him as well as to the people. That's how much he's entered into this traumatic experience. And to crush my young men. So he realizes, Jeremiah, incidentally he was in the priesthood, Jeremiah, he was not the high priest, but he was a priest and in a very high position. You could only have two at the time, but he was in the upper echelon of the priesthood, Jeremiah, but in his outspoken situation, in the eyes of his fellow ministers, he was looked down upon as a traitor. A traitor to the priesthood, a traitor to the nation, because he spoke about the enemy going to be successful. So we sometimes forget. And so when he says, my people, if you were a priest, and you were, say living back there, and you were that high up in the priesthood, let us say even as the high priest, you would consider the people my people, even though it's God's people. It's not your people. But because of your ministry, the way providence has put into your hands, whether you're a king or a president, whether you're the president of the United States, if you're conscientious, you feel that the welfare, not your welfare, but the welfare of the nation, is you are committed to that. That's true leadership when you really think of the prosperity of those underneath your administration, the rich, the poor, the no matter what the status is, you're thinking like Lincoln did of all the people. You know, Lincoln had that attitude in his emotional makeup. So here he speaks of my people when they're really they're God's people, but he had a responsibility which he is fulfilling. Jeremiah fulfilled it properly. and to crush my young men. The Lord hath trodden the burden of the daughter of Judah as a wife. For these things I weep. This is Jeremiah speaking, not the Lord. For these things I weep. Mine eye runneth down with water, because the comforter that should relieve my soul is far from me. My children are desolate because the enemy prevailed. Now it's this failure to see this traumatic entrance of Jeremiah into the field. They're thinking the Lord is doing this crying. The Lord is punishing them. Zion spread forth her hands, there's none to comfort her. The Lord hath commanded concerning Jacob, his adversary should be round about him. Jerusalem is as a menstruous woman among them. And you can see the beggar for alms, for food, to get a day's crumbs. And they look up at the people going by, and they raise their hands, you know, and they say, have mercy on me, like, and there's no mercy as it is extended. So he's speaking figuratively of the situation that exists. Very next verse says the Lord is righteous. So we will conclude here. And God willing, we start if there's another study, rather than try to pursue.